Last time we were looking at Psalm 3. That was 2 weeks ago. And you remember that Psalm 3 is a psalm of David when he fled from his son Absalom. And so we talked about that terrible time in the life of King David. His son Absalom began a rebellion against his own father. And many of David's closest friends and counselors joined the rebellion. And David had to flee from his capital city, Jerusalem, and take refuge in the desert. And Absalom, his son, did the most horrible and wicked things. Absalom raped David's wives, his concubines, in public, simply in order to bring humiliation and shame upon David, his father. We thought about what it must have been like for David, a refugee out in the wilderness, being hunted by his son Absalom, knowing that he was in danger of his life, knowing that the nation that he led was being torn apart by civil war, and knowing that all these things had come upon him as a result of his own sinfulness and folly. You remember we traced back the events that led to Absalom's rebellion, and we saw that so much was just the result of David's own sin against Bathsheba and Uriah, and then David's folly in the way that he brought up his family. And I was amazed when I came to Psalm 3 and verse 5 and read these words: I lie down and sleep, and I wake again, because the Lord sustains me. That was the great thing that we saw in Psalm 3, that this man David, in that terrifying situation, betrayed, heartbroken, ashamed of his past sins, in a situation of crisis, could still say, I lie down and sleep. Could still say, I wake up again, because the Lord sustains me. That's Psalm 3. It's a morning psalm, as you can see. David sings that psalm when he wakes up after a night there in the wilderness. Now, tonight, as we come to Psalm 4, you'll see that Psalm 4 is a companion psalm for Psalm 3. The two psalms go together. They're written as a pair. You'll find that there are all sorts of links, even in terms of the words and the phrases that David uses in these two psalms. In Psalm 3, verse 1, you have in the NIV, O Lord, how many are my foes? But literally it says, O Lord, how many are they that distress me? And then David in Psalm 4, verse 1 says, give me relief from my distress. In Psalm 3, verse 2, you read, many are saying about me, God will not deliver him. But then in Psalm 4 and verse 6, you read, many are saying, it's the same word, many are saying, who can show us any good? That phrase, many are saying, these are the only two places in the Psalms, in the whole book of Psalms, where that phrase is found. Many are saying this. Many are saying this. You'll see that in Psalm 3, verse 3, the Lord is spoken of as my glorious one. But again, it's actually my glory. The NIV has interpreted it as my glorious one, but what David wrote was simply, you are a shield around me, O Lord, my glory and the lifter of my head. And then in Psalm 4, verse 2, you read, how long, O men, will you turn my glory into shame? And most striking of all, you have in Psalm 3, verse 5, I lie down and sleep, and I wake again. And then in Psalm 4, verse 8, you read, I will lie down, and I will sleep in peace. This is the evening psalm that matches the morning psalm. In the morning, David says, I wake again. And then at evening, he says, I will lie down again and sleep in peace. These two psalms clearly belong together. And I think it's fair to assume then that they arise out of the same event. That this is still David's response to the crisis when he fled from his son Absalom. Maybe a few days have gone by since the situation of Psalm 3, but we're still talking about the same tragic situation in which David has been humiliated. David has been driven into exile by his own son Absalom. Let's just go through the psalm then, Psalm 4, and just pick out some of the key features of this psalm. In verse 1, David is addressing the Lord. Answer me when I call to you, O my righteous God. Give me relief from my distress. Be merciful to me and hear my prayer. Here is a man who in the time of crisis knows that he must come to God. He knows he must approach God and have dealings with God. It isn't always easy to do that. You would think that when we are in a situation of crisis and confusion and distress, that it would be the most natural and easy thing in the world to speak to God. But very often it isn't so. Because it's at the time of crisis, it's at the time when everything is in confusion, that all sorts of thoughts and distractions crowd in to stop us from speaking to God. Maybe we say, I must pray to God about this. And we start. But before we've spoken three or four words, a flood of thoughts have come into our mind. Have I done this? Have I done that? What if that happens? What if that happens? What's going to happen about this? We find ourselves prevented from speaking coherently to God at all by all the distracting thoughts that crowd in from every side. And yet, it is God we need to speak to. We need to focus our minds. And we need to speak, I need to speak to my God. There has to be that interaction between myself and my God. That is my only hope. In the time of crisis, in the time of need, that I should establish contact with the God who listens. So David focuses his mind, and he is determined that he will address God. And he pleads with God to listen to him. Answer me when I call to you. Here in this one verse, David, I think, uses four arguments to encourage himself as he prays to God, as he speaks to God. Four reasons to believe that God will listen to him, that God will answer him. answer me when I call to you, O my righteous God. There's the first argument. Literally, it's O God of my righteousness. David reminds himself that God is the God who upholds righteousness. God is the God who wants to see righteousness prevail. Now, here in this situation, however it's come about, clearly unrighteousness, wickedness is prevailing. This wicked man Absalom has become a traitor. And many other people have joined in that treason, that betrayal. And they are involved in doing horrible and wicked things. And they're planning to do more wicked things. And so David looks up to God and says, O God, you are the God of righteousness. And you're the God of my righteousness. You're on my side in this, because you know that I'm fighting for righteousness. And so, God, I'm looking to you to intervene on my side. I'm looking to you to step in, to break the power of evil here, to prevent unrighteousness from triumphing. In the end, David is praying exactly as we pray at the beginning of the Lord's Prayer, when we say, Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Lord, you are the God of heaven. You are the God who dwells in a place of perfect righteousness. Where you are, all things are done righteously. Well then, Lord, if you love righteousness, make righteousness happen on earth. We're entitled to pray in that way, aren't we? Whenever it seems that wickedness is prevailing, whenever it seems that righteousness is being trodden underfoot, we appeal to God because he's the God of righteousness and because he loves righteousness. David in this situation is entitled to expect God to intervene because he's the God of righteousness. Secondly, he's the God of past providences. Answer me when I call to you, O my righteous God. Give me relief from my distress. Literally, again, it's not an imperative. Give me relief. It's a reflection on the past. What he actually says is, You have relieved me when I was in distress. David can look back on so many occasions when God has stepped in and rescued him when he was distressed. It's been true all through David's life. That time when he was just a lad and he was guarding his sheep, and suddenly out of the undergrowth breaks that lion. And David's only got a moment to cry to God. It's terrifying. God intervenes. God gives him victory over the lion and over the bear. A time when David is at the battlefront and he's just standing a stripling under the shadow of giant Goliath. And God intervenes and God gives him victory and sends the stone flying true. A day when David was driven from his court, from Jerusalem, by the paranoid maniac King Saul. And Saul launches a manhunt determined to kill David. And oh, how often he came close to capturing and slaying David. And God intervened. God rescued David again and again. David can look back on so many deliverances. And now David can turn that into prayer and says, Since you've given me relief so often in the past, are you now going to fail me, O Lord? You've shown what you are like. You've shown your willingness to answer prayer. Have you suddenly changed? No, it's unthinkable. His love in time past forbids me to think he ever would leave me in trouble to sink. Every deliverance, every providence that I can look back on gives me fresh assurance that God will be there to hear me in the future. I expect this from my own children. I expect my children to get to know my character as the years go by. What sort of dad have I been to them? Have I been kind to them? Have I come and helped them when they've been hurt? Have I given them the things they've needed? As the years go by, they get to know me. And then surely they should have confidence in me as the years go forward, because they've seen what I'm like. Well, David knows what God is like because of his own experience of God over the years. And now he's turning that into prayer again. And then the third thing that David can use to reassure himself as he speaks to God is the fact that God is the God of mercy. Answer me when I call to you, O my righteous God, give me relief from my distress. Be merciful to me. God is a God of mercy. You know what mercy is? You look at somebody who is in distress, somebody who is in need, and you feel for them. And then you do something about it because you feel for them. What sort of God do we have? This God who created the whole universe. What's he like? He's a God of mercy. He feels for people when they're struggling, when they're suffering. Especially he feels for his own children, his own people. And because he feels for them, he does something about it. David is saying to God, be merciful to me. Since that's your character, show mercy. And then the fourth thing about God that David can appeal to is simply this, that God is a God of individuals. God is a God who cares about individuals. Isn't it striking when you read through this first verse just how personal it is? Answer me when I call to you, O God of my righteousness, give me relief from my distress. Be merciful to me. Hear my prayer. David obviously believes that God cares about individuals. Not just about mass movements, not just about nations, not just about great congregations. But David believes that God is the sort of God who listens to one person's call. God is the sort of person who cares about one person's distress. God's the sort of God who gives relief to one individual. God is the sort of God who feels merciful towards one person. God hears one man's prayers. There's something intensely personal about this. As far as David is concerned, at this moment there are only two people in the world and they're in contact, himself and God. And he believes that God feels towards him in that way. You know, it's a very good thing to have people praying for you. It's very good if there are people, many people who know about you and are willing to pray for you. It's very good if you can be with a large group of people who are all praying together. But you know, I do wonder at times if Christians somewhere inside themselves doubt whether God will listen to them if it's just that one person praying. It's as if some Christians feel that they need to recruit the help of dozens more people before God will listen to them. Because they can't quite believe that God would be interested in their heart cry, in their own one person feelings of distress. Yet, David believed it. David believed that this God in heaven would hear one man calling to him in his distress, that God would be merciful to that one man, that God would listen to that one man's prayers. That's what part of what it means to live as a believer, to believe that when you pray, God listens to your prayers as if you were the only person in the universe praying. He listens to your prayers as if there was nobody else in the universe who needed his help. That God has that personal, individual concern for you. David believes that. He believes that God is the God who upholds righteousness. He believes that God is the God of past providences. He believes that God is a God whose heart is mercy. And he believes that God really cares about one individual who calls to him in distress. So firstly, David addresses God. But then, because he has addressed God, David now has confidence to look at the situation. And to look at all the other people who are involved in this situation. Perhaps he wouldn't have dared to do that before. It would have been too terrifying. But now David surveys the scene. And he speaks to all the other people who are involved. Some of them maybe will actually hear him singing this psalm. Some of them he knows are out there somewhere. And in his imagination, he's telling them what they need to hear. But here in verses 2 through to 6, David is viewing all the different types of people. I think that here David has in mind three different types of people who in different ways are involved in this situation. First of all, there are the people who are clearly hostile to David, his enemies. What does David have to say to them? How long, O men, will you turn my glory into shame? How long will you love delusions and seek false gods? Know that the Lord has set apart the godly for himself. The Lord will hear when I call to him. There are men out there, Absalom and his cronies, who want to turn David's glory into shame. Now that's a difficult phrase. And different Bible scholars disagree about exactly what it means. You can certainly get a general idea of what it means. But what exactly does it mean? There are some who say, well, all it's saying is that they want to humiliate David. David has a glory as king, but they want to trample David down and turn his glory into humiliation and shame. And certainly that's true. That's what Absalom wants to do. That's why he carried out that act of such wickedness against David's wives. And Absalom hates David. And Absalom wants to see his dad stripped of any dignity. He wants to drag him in chains back to Jerusalem. And then put him through degrading rituals before finally executing him. That's what Absalom would love to do. He'd certainly like to take David's glory and trample it in the dust. But I think there's more to it than that. And the reason I say it is because the phrase here, my glory, has been used already in Psalm 3. And in Psalm 3, my glory is a title that David uses for the Lord himself. Psalm 3, verse 3, you are a shield around me, O Lord, my glory, the lifter up of my head. My glory for David isn't just something abstract. It's the Lord himself. It's the Lord that's his glory. So how can David's enemies be trying to turn the Lord David's glory into shame. Well, I suspect that what David is saying is this, that the Lord who is my glory, they want to use as a weapon against me, to humiliate me, to bring shame upon me. They want to use the Lord himself, the name of the Lord, as a pretext for shameful things and for piling shame on me. Instead of the Lord being my glory, they want the Lord to be a source of shame for me. You can see that in the account of Absalom's rebellion. You can see that Absalom and his friends, his fellow rebels, in the most horrible way, used the Lord's name as a pretext for attacking David and doing disgusting and horrible things against David. I'll give you a couple of examples from the account in 2 Samuel. You get this. This is how Absalom's rebellion began. At the end of 4 years, Absalom said to the king, David his father, "Let me go to Hebron and fulfill a vow I made to the Lord." What was the vow Absalom had made to the Lord? He had vowed to kill his own father. He said, "I've made this vow to the Lord." David doesn't ask him what it is. Then he goes on to give a twisted version. "I made this vow, if the Lord takes me back to Jerusalem, I'll worship the Lord in Hebron." And the king said to him, "Go in peace." So Absalom went to Hebron. And then he talks about how Absalom offered sacrifices there in Hebron. Absalom really, in his twisted, deluded mind, thought that the Lord was going to help him in this attack on his own father. That in some way he had the Lord's approval in what he was doing. He was going to do it in the Lord's name, in fulfillment of a vow made to the Lord. Later on, you get one of Absalom's supporters, this man Shimei, who curses David as David is leaving Jerusalem. And this is what he says, get out, you man of blood. You scoundrel, the Lord has repaid you for all the blood you shed in the household of Saul. The Lord has handed the kingdom over to your son Absalom." Do you see David's enemies, wicked men, men full of hatred, men full of blasphemy, are using the Lord's name in an attempt to pour ignominy and shame on David. It's horrible. No wonder David says to these people, "How long will you love delusions and seek false gods?" Again, literally, "and seek lies." What a delusion they're living in. That the Lord is going to help them. That the Lord is for them when they do these wicked things against David. Reminds you of so many horrible things in the history of the church. The torturers of the Inquisition, who drag men and women who love Christ into the torture chambers and stand there and gloat as God's faithful ones scream in agony. And why do they do it? They do it in the name of the Lord. They say they do it in order to defend the holy faith. They do it for the glory of God. But go back before that. Go back to the priests in Jerusalem who took the Son of God and tortured him and nailed him to a cross to die, and who did it in the name of the Lord. In their delusion, in some horrible way, they believed that they were acting for the Lord. That's how evil can be. That's how twisted the minds of proud religious men can be. That they can hate in the name of the Lord. That they can curse in the name of the Lord. They can torture in the name of the Lord. That's what Absalom was doing. That's what the chief priests did to Jesus. That's what Saul of Tarsus did to those whom he dragged off to prison. David, there in the wilderness, is conscious of the fact that there are men out there whose hearts are full of rage and cruelty and who feel justified in doing the most disgusting things and who want to humiliate him and who are driven by a deluded belief that God is with them in doing it. And David says this, know that the Lord has set apart the godly for himself. The faithful ones. Those who are true to the covenant. Absalom. Ahithophel. Don't pretend that you're acting in the name of the Lord. When you do wicked things. When you do ungodly things. It's the godly that the Lord has set apart for himself. But it is frightening, isn't it? It's frightening when God's people are pursued and persecuted, not just by the atheists, not just by the godless, but when they know they're hated by those who think of themselves as the righteous, those who think that they've got God on their side. David's conscious that there are those people out there. And then David speaks to a second group, I think, in verse 4 and 5. I think he's speaking now to some among his own men, to some among those who are loyal to him. When David flees from Jerusalem, there is a small body of troops that go with him. Loyal men, led by a man like Joab. When Shimei, whom I spoke of a moment ago, when he cursed David, one of David's men, Abishai, was very quick to react. Abishai said to the king, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over and cut off his head. There were people like that in David's entourage. Men like Abishai and Joab were just full of anger and rage against the rebels. And they wanted to take savage action against the rebels. David speaks to such men as Joab and Abishai, his own men, and says, in your anger, do not sin. When you're on your beds, search your hearts and be silent. David has to say that to his own men. He says, look, anger, rage, bitterness is going to achieve nothing. Search your own hearts. Look and see what sin there is in your own hearts. Instead of just raging against the bad people out there, look at yourselves and then be silent. And offer right sacrifices. And trust in the Lord. These men, David's companions, are lying awake all night. On their beds, they're lying there, thinking about how they're going to deal with Absalom. And what they're going to do to the wicked people who have assaulted David. They're planning vengeance. They're getting themselves worked up. And David's saying to them, look, calm down. Calm down. We don't need to get ourselves worked up in this situation. All right, it's frightening. All right, what they're doing out there is wicked. But what's to be gained by letting your own hearts be full of anger and rage? Come before the Lord. Offer him sacrifices. Trust in the Lord. Can't you leave it to God to change this situation? Can't you leave it to God to overrule? It's strange, isn't it? David is the one who's the focus of the rebellion. He's the one against whom Absalom and the others are directing their rage. David's the one they want to kill. David's the one who's been betrayed. David's the one who's been hurt. And yet he's the one who's having to calm down his followers and saying, look, you don't have to get so agitated about all this. Calm down. It's all in the Lord's control, you know. You can trust the Lord in this situation. You can leave it with him. David shines at this point, doesn't he? That here he is, a man hated, a man hunted, a man betrayed. And instead of being revved up and furious and enraged and pouring out curses against his enemy and lying awake all night and working himself up, instead he's the one who's spreading calm among his followers and saying, calm down, all of you. It's in the Lord's hands. Again, reminds you of the Lord Jesus, doesn't it? Great David's greater son, when those wicked men break in upon him in the Garden of Gethsemane, and Judas comes and betrays him with a kiss, and Peter pulls out his sword and starts lashing out, strikes the ear off the servant of the high priest, and Jesus says, Peter, put up your sword. This is in God's control. This is my Father's plan. You don't have to fight. Here, something of the spirit of Jesus Christ. You can see it in David, who refuses to become enraged, refuses to curse, refuses to become agitated. He's telling himself and he's telling others, trust in the Lord. And then there's a third group of people. And you see them in verse 6. And these are the doubtful people. Perhaps the discouraged people. Again, I think these are people whose sympathy basically is with David. They're his supporters. They identify themselves with him. Who can show us any good? They count themselves as belonging with David. But they're discouraged. They've lost all hope in this situation. And they're saying, well, it's hopeless, isn't it? No way out. Who can show us any good? Nothing's going to change. Things are just going to get worse. No way out of this situation. All right, we'll stand with you, David. But Absalom's going to win, isn't he? What does David have to say to these people? Well, nothing. It's very difficult to reason people out of that sort of pessimism. When somebody's reached the point where he says, oh, no good can come in this situation. Oh, there's no hope. Very difficult to reason with them. But David can pray for them. Let the light of your face shine upon us, O Lord. Lord, some of my friends here are feeling so grey They feel that they're in such darkness. They feel that everything is so hopeless. Lord, let the light of your face shine upon us. Let them catch a glimpse of your glory, your power, your love, your grace, and all the greyness, all the depression will vanish with the morning light. Let the light of your face shine upon us. O Lord, you're the covenant God, you're Jehovah. Well, now I prayed for myself at the beginning, but now I'm praying for these, my discouraged friends. Shine upon us. David is acting like a high priest, isn't he? You remember the high priest comes out and pronounces the blessing over his people. Well, now David is using the same blessing. Make the light of your countenance to shine upon us. He's taking these people under his wing. Again, he's the one who's been battered. He's the one who's been attacked. He's the one who suffered more than any of them. And yet somehow he's finding the grace to pray for them, that the Lord will encourage them. For his enemies, wicked people, he's got nothing but rebuke. You fools who think that you can use God's name to justify your wickedness. For his angry followers, agitated and worked up, he's got wise counsel. And for his doubting, fearful friends, he's got prayer and blessing. He understands that they are struggling. He understands why they feel so discouraged. And he can embrace them in his prayers. And now, finally, David turns back to speak to the Lord about himself again. He started at the beginning of the prayer of the psalm, calling out to God, praying for mercy. And now he can say this: you filled my heart with greater joy than when their grain and new wine abound. Yeah, at harvest time, when the grain's been gathered in and the new wine is flowing, people rejoice then. But David's not in that situation. He's out in the wilderness with a few sacks of grain to be shared among all his men. They don't perhaps know where their next meal's going to come from. They got none of the provisions that men would rejoice in. But David can say, my heart's full of joy. Extraordinary. Again, it's amazing when you see it, isn't it? The power of grace. That a man in David's situation, a man betrayed and harassed, a man with hating enemies out there and crazy friends around him causing him hassle and discouraged pessimists trying to burden him. Isn't it amazing that he can say, my heart's bubbling over with joy. And he can say, I lie down and sleep in peace. Is it possible? Is the psalm true? Was it really like that? Yeah, it was. David out there in the wilderness, in those circumstances, he really had a heart full of joy. He really was able to lie down in peace and sleep at night. Why? Because you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. David knew he was safe. Because the Lord is the Lord. Because he's the unchanging one. He's the one whose promises are the same for all eternity. And he makes David dwell in safety. David knows he's safe. Come what may, David is safe. If Absalom attacks this night while they're asleep, David is safe. If somehow David's life is cut short, David is safe. come what may, David is safe. He has the promise of an eternal God who has promised never to stop loving him, never to let go of him. David is safe. Because of that, he can rejoice. I read to you Philippians 1, didn't I, at the beginning of the meeting? For the sake of the New Testament parallel, Paul, there in a prison in Rome, not knowing what the future holds, not knowing if he's going to be left to moulder there for years, or whether he's going to be brought out and executed, or whether he's going to be released and then go back to those to those wearisome travels, being chased from town to town, being stoned and shipwrecked and flogged. Paul doesn't know what lies ahead for him. He knows, like David knew, that there are enemies who hate him, and that some of them are people who do it in the name of the Lord, who are trying to make his life a misery. He's got the Romans against him. He's got the Jews against him. And he knows he's got some people who call themselves Christians who are against him, who hate him, who feel nothing but jealousy against him, and are trying to stir up trouble for him. Doesn't know what's going to happen. Will he live? Will he die? Will he be tortured? Will he be flogged? Will he be executed in the arena? Will he spend year after year locked in that prison cell? He says, I belong to Christ. In life or in death, I belong to Christ. For me to live is Christ. And for me to die is gain. Because then I'll see Christ. He's safe. Whatever happens, he's safe, and he knows he's safe. Nobody can harm him. Not in the long run. He's secure for eternity. And Paul in that prison cell says, I rejoice. And I will continue to rejoice. Letter to the Philippians, read it through. Is it full of dark depression? No, it's a letter that's bubbling over with joy. I wish I knew more of David's secret. Inexperience. I wish I knew more of Paul's secret. I wish I could say, I rejoice and I'll continue to rejoice, come what may. But I can, though. It doesn't have to be an idle wish. I need to know more about God. I need to have a clearer grasp on this, that God has loved me. That he loved me enough to send his son to die for me. That he's promised me for Jesus' sake that he'll never let go of me. I'm safe. If I hold on to that, if that truth fills my heart and fills my mind, then I'll rejoice. When I'm conscious that some people hate me, I'll rejoice. When I'm conscious that some of my friends are causing problems, I'll rejoice. When I hear other people muttering away in a pessimistic and dreary way, I'll rejoice. A person who knows that they belong to Christ has the secret of joy in any and every situation. I will lie down in peace and sleep, for you, Lord, make me dwell in safety. Can you lie down in peace and sleep tonight? If you belong to Christ, then you are eternally safe, and you can lie down in peace, and you can sleep.